From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. President Trump says he'll take the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement, and Democrats are outraged.
The president said he wants to make America first. America is now dead last when it comes to the stewardship of our planet.
Later this hour, Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois on climate change and where political winds may blow for his party. And librarians in Philadelphia who've learned how to try to prevent drug deaths right inside their library. A conservative commentator on President Trump's praise for a tyrant, now the one in the Philippines. And music that's now in heavy rotation. BJ Lederman writes our theme music. It's Saturday, June 3rd, 2017.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Explosions are being reported in the Afghan capital of Kabul a day after clashes between police and protesters calling for more security following Wednesday's truck bombing that killed more than 80 people and wounded hundreds. Challengers to President Trump's revised travel ban have until June 12th to respond to the administration's appeal of court orders blocking the restrictions. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports that the deadline marks an unusually quick turnaround for the high court.
Thursday night, the Justice Department asked the Supreme Court to reverse a May federal appeals court ruling that struck down the ban on travelers from six predominantly Muslim countries. The lower court ruled the ban an unconstitutional form of religious discrimination. The Supreme Court's call for a response from the challengers by June 12th suggests that the justices may be considering a special session to hear arguments in the case in the summer or early fall. Or, with the current term expected to end later this month, the justices may simply want to move the case more quickly so that it will be ready for arguments in October at the beginning of the next term. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Following President Trump's decision to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement, questions remain about whether he believes in climate change. Although Trump has questioned it in the past, he has not offered an opinion since he became president. Several top officials were asked about his views this week, including Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt. During a White House briefing, Pruitt did not answer the question directly.
The discussion over the last several weeks has been one of a thoughtful deliberation. He heard many voices, voices across a wide spectrum of vantage points, and the president made a very informed and, I think, thoughtful and important decision for the country's benefit.
As world leaders pledge to boost efforts to curb global warming, former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is among those urging local officials to pursue policies that combat climate change. He's pledging $15 million through his foundation to the UN to help meet the U.S. contribution under the Paris Agreement. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis says he's encouraged by China's efforts to resolve the North Korean nuclear issue. His remarks echo those of President Trump, as NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Beijing.
Speaking at a regional security conference in Singapore, Mattis praised China's efforts to cooperate with the U.S. and others on North Korea. But he assailed China's island building in the South China Sea, which he said shows
China's disregard for international law, its contempt for other nations' interests, and its efforts to dismiss non-adversarial resolution of issues.
Mattis was asked whether the U.S. pullout from international agreements on climate change and trade threatened to undermine the international order the U.S. claims to be upholding. Mattis simply replied that the Trump administration has fresh approaches to these issues. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
And you're listening to NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Sharon Brody in Boston. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker says he's joining a coalition of other governors, and that way the state will be able to follow through on its plan to reduce greenhouse gases further than the goal of the Paris Climate Agreement. Baker and the governor of Vermont are the first Republicans to join the United States Climate Alliance, created in response to the president's decision to withdraw from the Paris Accord. So far, searchers along the Charles River near the Esplanade have not been able to locate a woman who was reported missing by her boyfriend. State troopers say they found the boyfriend sitting in a westbound lane of Starro Drive around 2 o'clock this morning. The man told troopers that his girlfriend had gone into the Charles River Lagoon and that he could not find her. The mother of the murdered Boston toddler, once known as Baby Doe, returns to the stand Monday in the murder trial of her former boyfriend. WBUR's Steve Brown reports on the mother's initial testimony yesterday.
Rochelle Bond says Michael McCarthy was fascinated with astrology, Reiki, and conspiracy theories, and that she would often take heroin with him and a friend. She says McCarthy also told her she should be disciplining her daughter more. Bond tearfully described the night she went in to see McCarthy in her daughter's bedroom.
And you say that he punched her in the stomach?
Yes.
With his fist?
Yes.
How would you describe the force of that blow?
I don't know. I just saw her bounce off the bed.
Bond said McCarthy threatened to kill her if she said anything. She said he took her to a pier and then threw the girl's body into the harbor. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Steve Brown.
In the forecast for the Boston area, chance of showers today, thunderstorms possible this afternoon, and highs in the mid-60s. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the law firm of Nutter McLennan and Fish, counsel to leading companies and institutions for more than a century. Client-focused, collaborative, this is Nutter, online at Nutter.com. The BSO, hear Beatles and other rock music, hosted by WZLX Breakfast with the Beatles host, Chachi Lapret, June 8th, 10th, and 11th, bostonpops.org. And Inada, creators of the Japanese-made Dreamwave massage chair, with shiatsu point detection and 16 program massages, including morning and nighttime sessions. Retail dealers nationwide. More at dreamwavechair.com.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
The Paris Climate Accord is simply the latest example of Washington entering into an agreement that disadvantages the United States to the exclusive benefit of other countries.
Several foreign leaders have called President Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Accord regrettable. Democrats have been using sharper language. Dick Durbin is the Democratic Minority Whip in the U.S. Senate. He joins us on the line now from his home in Springfield. Senator, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
The president said on Thursday that he is willing to work with Democratic leaders to negotiate what he called a better climate deal. Do you see that happening?
I hope that something like that does occur, but this was a fateful decision. The president said he wants to make America first. America is now dead last when it comes to the stewardship of our planet with this decision. We're going to regret this. And even more, we're going to regret what we've done to our kids and grandkids by not showing some responsibility in light of this challenge.
Should President Obama have submitted the Paris deal to the Senate for ratification to lock it in and bind U.S. policy to that commitment?
I don't think it had a chance in the Senate. The Republican majority just doesn't abide by the basics when it comes to science, climate change. They are captivated by a lot of special groups, the Koch brothers, for example, who have an interest in carbon fuels and such. And it makes it very difficult for any of them to cross the Koch brothers and risk a primary. So the passage of the Paris Accord as a treaty in the Senate was not likely.
Hmm. There are coal miners in southern Illinois, as I don't have to tell you, Senator Durbin. Stat I looked up this morning says 6% of the nation's coal is mined in Illinois. They're concerned about jobs. What do you say to them?
Well, I tell them that I am too. I'm concerned about good jobs that pay well and have a future. I've been down in the coal mines of southern Illinois, and it's hard to describe the machinery that is now in these coal mines. Any image that your listeners have who've never been near a coal mine is probably wrong. These massive machines called continuous miners have replaced dozens, if not hundreds, of coal miners, and they are able to technically remove this with very few people on hand. So to say this is the future, coal mine jobs and such, I think is to overstate the obvious. Technology, as well as the energy market nationwide and worldwide, has really changed the dynamics and future of coal.
Let me ask you about another issue, and that's health care. The Senate's been working on a health care bill to replace the Affordable Care Act. Several Republicans, and I'm thinking of Senator Burr, Senator Ernst, Chuck Grassley, said this week they think an overhaul is unlikely to pass. At the same time, premiums are rising. Many insurers are bowing out of the marketplaces. Don't the American people need some movement on health care?
They absolutely do. I voted for it, maybe one of the most important things I ever voted for. Cutting in half the percentage of Americans without health insurance was a dramatic step forward for millions of families to give them the peace of mind and protection. But it is far from perfect. We know that things need to be done. There is nothing in the current law that deals with the escalating prices of drugs and pharmaceuticals. we still don't have a public option, and I mean an option that people can choose if they wish, across this country. We need to expand the pool of those who are buying individual health insurance so we don't just attract the older and sicker people. That becomes a very expensive premium. There are things we can do as long as we do it together. The Republicans need to take repeal off the table. And if they do, the Democrats are ready to pull a chair up to the table.
Hmm. Do you have any specific policies or reforms you'd like to advance?
The three I mentioned: deal with the pharmaceuticals, make sure we have a public option that looks like Medicare all across the United States.
But that's all dependent, though, on the Republicans taking repeal off the table.
They do. If they take it off the table, then I think we can have this conversation. And I am heartened and encouraged talking to Susan Collins and Senator Cassidy of Louisiana, that they are really looking at this in serious terms.
Last question. What do you tell people the Senate's done so far this session?
We've basically done little. We have had a trickle of nominations from this new administration. It is just historically low, the number of names they've sent us. Yes, we did send a man to the Supreme Court, and that is historic and important. When it came down to the budget, though, the budget effort fell apart among Republicans in the House. We then moved to a bipartisan approach to it and passed the budget, which finishes this year. I think that is a model that we ought to look to the future. If we can work on a bipartisan basis for infrastructure, for real health care reform that continues to protect people, trying to make sure we deal with something on student loans for the families that are facing that burden, we can do this on a bipartisan basis. And I hope many Republicans, as we approach the election, will join us.
Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
Now that the Trump administration has announced it's withdrawing the United States from the Paris Climate Accord, China's environmental policies draw more interest. Alvin Lin is director of climate and energy policy for the Natural Resources Defense Council's China program, and he joins us via Skype from Beijing. Mr. Lin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
What do you hear from officials and maybe non-officials in Beijing following President Trump's announcement?
Well, you know, of course, they've been following this very closely. So I think they've been kind of prepared for it. And, you know, Friday, for example, the EU and China, they just concluded a bilateral, the leaders of their countries in Brussels. And upon hearing the announcement from Mr. Trump, they actually came out and announced that they would be strengthening their commitment to fighting climate change together. So I don't think this changes the Chinese position at all. And in fact, I think, you know, they're just going to go and do what they were going to do in terms of transitioning to a clean energy future.
Well, but and what drives them? Is it the prospect of international leadership or an international market, or, as I don't have to tell you, the fact that many Chinese choke on the smog in their own cities?
Yeah, well, there are definitely multiple factors. You know, about a decade ago, China passed their renewable energy law. They started to really grow wind and solar as the future strategic industries. And now they're the largest in the world. They install by far the most wind turbines and solar panels in the world. So they really can see that this is a future growth area, that this is something that they can export to other countries. And it has all of these environmental benefits. So, of course, to them, it just makes sense to do it.
Mm. So they see jobs in green energy.
That's right. You know, there's 3 million renewable energy jobs in China. That's the most in the world. Renewable energy jobs around the world, including in the U.S., are growing much faster than the overall job market. So there are definitely areas for growth.
At the same time, China is the world's largest coal user and producer, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, that's right. But it has actually peaked its coal consumption in 2013, and it's been falling the last 3 years. I think even the leaders here see that coal doesn't have a very bright future as an energy source, and that you've got to develop these non-emitting clean energy sources. So they have a mandatory target already to continue to reduce their coal consumption and then to increase their non-emitting clean power renewables into the future. So these are mandatory targets. Mm-hmm. They're setting in place the policies to reach them now.
And China sees a role in world leadership on this issue?
Yeah, you know, I think Chinese leaders are not going to use that words to describe themselves. They're sort of not ready to sort of take on that mantle, but they're certainly very willing and excited to work with other regions like the EU, like other developing countries. And I think they're kind of the de facto leader on climate change now, just because they're implementing what they said they're going to do in terms of wind and solar and energy efficiency.
Elvin Lin, Director of Climate and Energy Policy for the NRDC's China program. Thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Lin.
My pleasure.
The word of the week is covfefe. Ask your doctor about covfefe. Say it loud and there's music playing. Say it soft and it's almost like praying. Covfefe. 12:06 a.m. Wednesday morning, President Trump tweeted, "Despite the constant negative press, covfefe, and nothing more." Twitter runneth over with questions, speculation, gifs, and jokes, which we won't repeat because if there's anything worse than fake news in the news business, it's old jokes. Several people ran the word through translation software and briefly reported that covfefe is Samoan, which Samoans say it's not. I entered covfefe into a rhyme generator. No match, but Mojave and Gaddafi are rated as close. Way out o' the sands of the Mojave, the winds whip and whisper, covfefe. President Trump deleted his tweet at 5:50 a.m. Just after 6 a.m., he posted a new message. "Who can figure out the true meaning of covfefe?" he wrote, followed by three question marks. "Enjoy!" Like a lot of people, I assumed the president meant to type a complaint about negative press coverage, but his fingers misfired and tapped out covfefe. Who among us hasn't committed a typo? It's happened to you. It's happened to me. It's probably happened to J.K. Rowling. But John Spicer, the White House press secretary, who told reporters after President Trump was inaugurated this was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period, which it was not, and once uttered a horrifying gaffe that twisted the history of the Holocaust, seemed unwilling to accept that President Trump could be wrong about even a typo. He told reporters who asked about covfefe, "The president and a small group of people know exactly what he meant." The problem with trying to put a happy face on a gaffe is that it can pump air into wild and ludicrous theories. Late this week, some of President Trump's supporters insisted on social media that his covfefe was actually a shrewd and subtle presidential invocation of an ancient Arabic term for standing up against an attack. Language experts say it's not. But I'd like to try another explanation. Tweets travel at twice the speed of light. Please don't check that, by the way. Covfefe may be a signal President Trump sent this week in the middle of the night when he thought no one on Earth would notice to the people on a planet that is light years from our own. Reporters may wonder, but the people on covfefe know the president was saying, "Do you see any greenhouse gases down here?"
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of Radio Boston, just reminding you that you can listen to WBUR on the Cape and Islands at 89.1 and 92.7 FM.
It is 57 degrees in Boston at 8:18. Coming up on Weekend Edition Saturday, you'll hear about the book Everybody's Son, a novel exploring race, class, privilege, and power. A chance of showers today in Boston, some thunderstorms possible this afternoon, highs in the mid-60s, overnight lows in the low 50s, increasing clouds tomorrow with a chance of rain and temperatures in the upper 60s. This is 90.9 WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Dana-Farber Brigham and Women's Cancer Center, with specialists available to see new patients as soon as the next day. Call 877-DFCI-BWH or visit youhaveus.org. And Medallion Gallery, announcing the store closing June 30th. Hand-woven new and antique rugs in a variety of sizes and designs, available now. More at medalliongallery.com.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. Explosions are being reported in the Afghan capital of Kabul a day after violent clashes between police and protesters who are calling for more security following Wednesday's deadly truck bombing. The blasts are said to have gone off near the funeral for one of several protesters who died in yesterday's confrontation. Defense Secretary James Mattis praising China for working with the U.S. to help restrain North Korea. He spoke today at an annual security conference in Singapore. While he praised China, he also said the Trump administration would continue calling out Beijing over its activity in the South China Sea. And Vice President Pence is due in Iowa. He's traveling to Des Moines today for Senator Joni Ernst's annual summer fundraiser. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. From Visit St. Pete Clearwater, home of St. Pete Pride, June 23rd to 25th, featuring a nighttime LGBT parade that winds through St. Pete's downtown waterfront, at visitstpeteclearwater.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. President Trump has quarreled with a number of allies, including leaders in Britain, France, and Germany, but he has been unstinted in his praise of Rodrigo Duterte, president of the Philippines. The U.S. State Department 2016 Human Rights Report says that Philippine police and vigilantes have killed more than 6,000 suspected drug dealers and users in what amounts to a policy of official massacre. Hitler massacred 3 million Jews, Duterte said after his election last year, getting that number wrong, incidentally. Now there are 3 million drug addicts. I'd be happy to slaughter them. But in a May 23 transcript of President Trump's phone call, Trump invites Duterte to the White House and says, I just wanted to congratulate you because I am hearing of the unbelievable job on the drug problem, what a great job you were doing, and I just wanted to call and tell you that. Max Boot, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, writes about this on the website for Commentary Magazine. He joins us from New York. Mr. Boot, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You say that President Trump thereby associates himself with any human rights crimes committed in the Philippines. How so?
Well, the United States has a long relationship with the Philippines dating back more than a century. We have very close cultural and human and strategic and military ties to the Philippines, and we can use that influence for good or for ill. Now, President Trump is using his influence with the Philippines in a very negative way. Instead of restraining President Duterte from his human rights abuses and from the rule of law, Trump is egging him on, saying you're doing a great job when he's got death squads out there killing people. I mean, this is, it's outrageous. And, you know, there are so many outrages in the Trump White House, but this is one that we should not lose sight of.
Mr. Boot, what about the argument that how the Philippine government handles an insurgency by declaring martial law, say, in Mindanao, or drug crime for that matter, is their business? It's a matter of Philippine sovereignty.
Well, there's an element of truth to that, but we are a powerful ally of the Philippines, and it should matter to us whether our allies are upholding human rights and democracy or violating it. And normally, when we look the other way, it's a short-term expedient which comes back to bite us in the long run. I'm very worried that he will follow his idol, Ferdinand Marcos, by declaring nationwide martial law, which he will then use as an excuse for dictatorial rule.
President Trump has invited President Duterte to the White House. No date set yet that we know about. What do you think of that?
I think it's a travesty, and especially the way that he worded the invitation in this May 23 phone call, of which we have the transcript, where he said, you know, I would love to have you in the Oval Office anytime you want to come. Keep up the good work. You're doing an amazing job. I mean, this is how he talks to this deranged human rights abuser who is the president of the Philippines. Compare that to the way that he speaks to our closest democratic allies in Western Europe. Trump was reported to have said that Germany is very bad, very, very bad. And what is it that Germany is doing that's so bad? They're selling us a lot of cars that Americans want to buy. In Trump's mind, that's a grave sin. But going out and slaughtering people semi-randomly in the streets, as the president of the Philippines is doing, that's okay. I mean, this is not what America ought to be about.
Max Boot of the Council on Foreign Relations and Commentary Magazine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Department of Homeland Security may soon prohibit airline passengers from carrying laptops on flights to the United States from Europe. That means travelers on hundreds of flights each day would have to check those devices in their luggage. But European leaders, airlines, and others in the travel industry say that such a ban could have a chilling effect on travel. NPR's David Shaper reports.
Since March, the Trump administration has banned laptops, iPads, and other electronic devices larger than a smartphone from airplane cabins on U.S.-bound flights from 10 cities in the Middle East and Africa. Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly says terrorists have been working on developing smaller, thinner bombs that could hide inside a laptop and could conceivably bring down a plane. On Fox News Sunday this past weekend, Kelly called it a sophisticated threat.
That's really the thing that they're obsessed with, the terrorists, the idea of knocking down an airplane in flight, particularly if it's a U.S. carrier, particularly as full of mostly U.S. folks, people.
Homeland Security officials, including Kelly himself, have been discussing with European leaders whether to expand the restrictions on electronic devices to include flights between the U.S. and Europe. A Homeland Security spokesman says that possible expansion is still on the table, despite reports to the contrary this week, as officials also look into other ways to improve aviation security globally. Experts say the threat is real, and that explosives hidden in a laptop could get through carry-on screening equipment in some countries. Jeff Price is an expert in aviation security at Metropolitan State University in Denver. He says more countries need to employ better screening techniques.
If you can't find the explosive device or the prohibited item with the existing technology, then get better technology. And this is technology that's been around for a long time.
Stowing laptops in a plane's baggage hold raises another concern: the risk of lithium-ion laptop batteries catching fire. That happened Tuesday night on a cross-country JetBlue flight. The plane was diverted because of smoke emitting from a carry-on bag holding the electronic device, but the crew was able to quickly put out the fire. That might not be the case if the laptop is packed away in the cargo hold. And Michael McCormick of the Global Business Travel Association says business travelers in particular are concerned about handing over their laptops.
We've been trained now by our companies, and have been for some time, that you really never let your laptop or any of your electronics out of your sight.
McCormick says many travelers fear their laptops could be damaged or stolen, that sensitive data could be hacked, or that they'd just be stuck on a flight lasting 8, 10, even 12 hours or longer without being able to work.
We've become accustomed to being in touch and being productive all the time, so clearly productivity would also be affected.
McCormick says many business people may just hold meetings over Skype or other digital platforms instead of traveling overseas. That would hurt airlines, hotels, and other travel-related businesses both in the departing and destination countries. McCormick says just the uncertainty over the possible laptop ban, combined with other Trump administration restrictions on travel, is already proving disruptive and costly.
We expect the U.S. to lose about $1.3 billion in travel-related expenditures this year as a result of the cumulative effect of all these policies, largely based on travel that is being canceled or deferred coming from Europe and the Middle East.
If the laptop ban is expanded to include flights to and from Europe, Homeland Security officials say it will not likely happen this week, but it still remains a possibility during the busy summer travel season. David Shaper, NPR News.
McPherson Square Park, which is north of downtown Philadelphia, has become known as Needle Park. It's become what amounts to a gathering spot for drug users. And as this nation's opioid crisis has exploded, the staff of the public library in the center of the park have become first responders. Mike Newell is a columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and last week he wrote about a new assignment for librarians. They help overdose victims. Shira Kowalski is a librarian there at the McPherson Square branch of the Free Library of Philadelphia. They both join us now from member station WHYY. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Well, Mike, first tell us a bit about this neighborhood.
Well, it's a neighborhood that has been long underserved and long suffering with deep poverty, with drugs. The park there is right now in the center of the city's opioid epidemic. We don't want to have a reputation for having the purest and cheapest heroin, but sadly, I think we do.
Sure, Kowalski, what's it like in the library? What do you see?
Well, aside from having lots of community members come in, children, teens, and families, this past week, we've had 4 overdoses that I'm aware of to happen right out front of the library. Mm. As the warm weather increases, it becomes a daily occurrence.
And I gather the librarians there have been obliged to become involved in a way that, become involved in a way librarians aren't usually asked to become involved.
The way I've always thought of libraries are a responsive space that responds to the community needs. And in the situation that we're in, one of the needs are we have to help people who may be engaging in behaviors not many are comfortable with. When someone's overdosing, that's a need. And utilizing Narcan, it gives them a second chance.
I hope you don't mind me asking, but I understand you know about addiction personally.
Yes, both of my parents have been in recovery for over 20 years now.
That's that takes a lot of courage, doesn't it?
Yes. They have a strength that, like, the words I can't describe. To see them just keep trying has been amazing and inspiring. And so I take that and some of the experience I had growing up, and I just want to be a supportive person inside the library and the community and all.
Yeah. Mike Newell, what you've witnessed there, what does that say about what's happened in so many places in our country with the opioid crisis?
Well, it's, as I said, Kensington has long been a neighborhood that's been dealing with drug issues and poverty issues, and now you're seeing kids out there who are coming from North Carolina and South Carolina, from all over the country, who are out there on that lawn. It's a glimpse into the reach of the crisis, but also just the depth of it right now. I mean, I've had the chance to visit Shara 4 times at the library, and 3 times on those visits she's helped or saved someone's life. And it's going to be a long summer, and I hope that the front line of this defense isn't Shara running from behind the library desk. I know she will, but I hope that the city stands up and does what it needs to do right now.
In your mind, Mr. Newell and Shara Kowalski, what should the city, the state, the country do?
I really believe we need to dramatically change the way we treat addiction. We need to continue to destigmatize mental health and addiction as well. I think what we can do right now is to have more people be willing to train themselves on Narcan, because it really is a life-saving tool.
Mm-hmm. In the meantime, I mean, there's an opportunity for the city to get outreach workers there on a daily basis to talk to these folks, to see if they can pull any of them inside and get them into treatment. And I mean, there's a national opioid crisis, there's an epidemic in Philadelphia, but there's you know, a catastrophe, there's a crisis right now on that lawn.
Mike Newell of the Philadelphia Inquirer and Shara Kowalski, a librarian at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
And tomorrow on Weekend Edition, Sunday, Mayor James Brainerd of Carmel, Indiana, believes that he and other mayors can meet the goals of the Paris Accord at the local level. In Carmel, Mayor Brainerd has taken...
The city was designed for cars and turning it into a walkable city so that the average driver is in his car maybe a few minutes a day as opposed to the U.S. average of 2 hours or 100 miles.
A city's effort to combat climate change tomorrow on Weekend Edition Sunday. The New York Mets lost 7-1 to the Milwaukee Brewers on Wednesday, but the real loser was their mascot, Mr. Met. Mr. Met has a huge white baseball of a head dappled with red stitching and embellished with a perpetual grin. But as he left the playing field Wednesday night, Mr. Met flipped a middle finger to a group of fans who posted it on Twitter. Busted, Mr. Met! The club apologized, and the team employee in the Mr. Met costume that night has reportedly not returned. There were reports that fans heckled him, which fans deny. The Mr. Met's middle finger controversy poses a physical and philosophical question. Mr. Met has 4 fingers on each hand. How can you say that any of them is a middle finger? Anyway, flipping the bird in New York, isn't that just how they say good morning in Queens?
Oh, well, everybody's heard about the bird. Bird, bird, bird. The bird's the word. Oh, well, a bird, bird, bird. Bird is the word. Oh, well, a bird, bird.
Hi, I'm Mara Liasson. I've worked at NPR for 30 years, but before that, I was a listener. The alarm would go off in the morning, and there was NPR, A couple of times I fell back asleep while I was listening, and I saw the story I was listening to in my dream. That's how powerful it was. When I was a listener, I wanted to work here because I thought that NPR did the very best kind of journalism. 30 years later, I still do. Thanks for listening to this NPR station.
Baltimore has a new hero. Kyrie Myrick. He's 12 years old and the first national youth chess champion that city has ever had. 2 weeks ago in Nashville, he won a perfect score, 7-0. He took his division at the U.S. Chess Federation Super Nationals. Kyrie Myrick joins us on the line now from Baltimore. Congratulations. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a big opportunity for me to just been able to go there and do what I had to do.
Where'd you learn chess?
I learned at my elementary school, the Green School of Baltimore. My chess coach taught me there.
Why did you take up chess? What interested you?
Well, I was in first grade, and I just liked the way the pieces looked. And then I told my mom about it, and she just signed me up.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, I'm told you've played many games for practice in the back of a barbershop there in Baltimore.
Yes. Well, I learned how to play at my elementary school. Then I just go on and play at my barbershop.
People whose names you can share with us?
Yes, my barber, Sudiati, and the other barbers that are in there, Adwelli.
These are adults, right?
Yes.
Think they were giving you any breaks? Probably not.
No, they played me like I was any other customer.
Yeah. Can you tell us the moves that you made in Nashville that would particularly... I'm afraid I don't know much about chess, but people listening who know about chess might be impressed.
My opening that I play is the Scandinavian, but that's on black, and I think I was black my last winning game. The Scandinavian is an opening on black when the queen's pawn is pushed up two squares.
Now, you're a seventh grader at the Roland Park Middle School?
Yes.
Do you get kidded about being the chess champ?
No. Actually, a lot of people think it's cool, and a lot of my friends actually try to play me, even though none of them know how to actually play.
Well, you do have that advantage, don't you?
Yeah.
Kyrie, there's been some thinking over the years that that young people who excel at chess find that spills over into other areas of their studies and their schoolwork. Have you found that?
Yes. I think that chess is a lot like what I do in math because it takes a lot of problem solving and strategy, and you have to think way ahead before you start to make your plan.
Hmm. So you think it's helped you in planning, organization, that sort of thing?
Yeah, and everything and just being focused in school. Because in order to be successful, you actually need to know how to focus.
Hmm. You're 12 years old. Any idea what you want to be when you're an adult?
Well, chess-wise, I want to become a grandmaster. But in otherwise, I don't actually know yet.
Yeah. What interests you in school or in life?
I like math and engineering. I took a lot of engineering summer camps, and that really interests me a lot.
I have to ask. I mean, you follow the Orioles?
Yes. We're going to the Orioles today.
Are you really?
I actually get to play some of the players on the team.
Play chess?
Yes.
Oh, you ought to beat their orange behinds.
Maybe.
Well, we spoke to Kyrie Myrick yesterday afternoon, and he played some of the Oriole players, including Manny Machado and Jonathan Scope. He trounced them handily. Move. This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Sharon Brody. State police say a woman who was reported missing along the Esplanade early this morning has been located in a hospital where she is being treated for substance abuse issues. Police had begun a search for the woman when her boyfriend told state troopers he'd lost sight of her after she entered the Charles River Lagoon. Massachusetts Democrats gather at a convention in Worcester today to vote on a state party platform. The proposed platform calls for a single-payer health system, a $15 minimum wage, and free tuition at state universities and colleges. Beware of traffic delays on the Mass Pike in Boston this weekend near the ComAv Bridge. The Pike is reduced to two lanes in each direction with barriers in place between Alston Brighton and the Beacon Street overpass. The state's testing how traffic will flow next month and August during a major repair project on the ComAv Bridge. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Diedrichs in Cambridge and at the Mill at Newton Lower Falls. Outdoor furniture, tableware, and home accents. Diedrichs. Online at DIDRIKS.com. And Fidelity Investments, reminding you it's never too early to start saving for your child's future. Learn more about a tax-advantaged 529 college savings account at Fidelity.com/UFund. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE, SIPC.
Emotions are powerful things. Sometimes it feels like they just take you over.
But what if that's not the way it works? What if we've been thinking about emotions all wrong?
Sometimes you can let emotions control your behavior.
This week, Invisibilia is looking at a whole new way of thinking about our emotions. That's Invisibilia from NPR.
That's tomorrow night at 8 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the belief that all lives have equal value and working with partners to help envision a world where every person has the opportunity to live a healthy, productive life at gatesfoundation.org. From C3IoT, providing a software platform that brings machine learning, big data, and cloud computing to industrial-scale predictive analytics and IoT solutions. Learn more at c3iot.com. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. A new play at Chicago's Goodman Theater seems ripped from the headlines. A young man escapes a deadly civil war, then confronts new dangers in the country where he's found shelter. Objects in the Mirror is based on the true story of Shedrick Yarpai, a young actor who escaped Liberia during war and settled in Australia. From member station WBEZ, Dan Weissman has the story.
American playwright Charles Smith met Shedrick Yarpai when a theater company in Adelaide, Australia, produced two of Smith's plays with Yarpai in the lead. Smith traveled to see the productions. Afterwards, he went to lunch with Yarpai and the theater's artistic director, Rob Crozer. Here's how Smith and Yarpai remember it.
Rob and Shedrick and I sat down and we were having lunch. And
then Rob said to me, "Say it."
And Shedrick said, "Well, I have something to tell you."
I started telling Charles my story.
His escape from Liberia and the crushing questions he still faced.
I was just amazed by it. I was just blown away. I said to him, "I would like to write this."
And I didn't see a word.
I think he cried and I cried. And we took off from there.
The play is about identity, the danger of telling the truth and of concealing it. In the first act, Shedrick tells a friend, a sympathetic lawyer, about his harrowing escape and the baggage that weighs him down. He came to Australia under someone else's name, a cousin who died in the war.
I lied to the government and that makes me a criminal. And every day I lie, I sink deeper and deeper, and now I am drowning, Mr. Rob.
The lawyer offers to help Shedrick correct the record, but Shedrick's uncle John has grave concerns. He risked his own life and orchestrated multiple lies to get the family out.
You think the danger is behind us, that it's in the past, but it's not that far behind us, Zasa. The objects in the mirror are closer than they appear.
He reminds Shedrick, whom he carefully addresses by his fake name, that he can't leave behind the social reality of race.
You will always be only one of two things in the world, either a commodity or a liability. There is no in-between.
Uncle John flat out forbids Shedrick to move forward with reclaiming his given name.
As your father, I forbid you.
You're not my father.
I saved your life.
And what good is my life without me?
Playwright Charles Smith says it was Shedrick Yarpai's account of this exchange that sparked Objects in the Mirror.
And in my head, I heard Shedrick's response, and the response was, "Well, what good is my life without me?" And I thought, this is just an incredible decision. It's a Shakespearean decision.
It's been 8 years since Smith heard this story. The Goodman Theater had hoped to bring Shedrick Yarpai to Chicago for the opening.
you know, especially traveling at this time to the United States is not as easy.
In putting together his visa application, Yarpai discovered that some documents from when he arrived in Australia still showed the name he had used to enter. Speaking from a studio in Australia, Yarpai says he commiserated with theater director Rob Crozer.
I told Ross, look, I think I would have just stuck with the identity I came with. This would have been easier. He started laughing about it, you know, but it wasn't fun.
In the end, it was Crozer who traveled to Chicago to see the premiere at the Goodman Theater.
I found it one of the most emotional experiences that I've undergone in a long, long time.
Crozer saw a version of himself on stage as the lawyer who helps Shedrick straighten out his identity. That's a role he played in real life. Crozer earned his living as a lawyer, running the theater in his spare time. But Objects in the Mirror complicates his role. In Act Two, Shedrick's Uncle John accuses the lawyer of trying to steal the young man he calls his son.
Your white skin and your governmental position does not give you the right to take a man's son away simply because you believe you can give him a better life.
On opening night, some people in the audience applauded that speech. The next day, Rob Crozer and Charles Smith debriefed.
I found that quite confronting, I've got to say.
You know, Rob, I think there are a lot of audiences who agree with you.
Mm.
And I think there are a lot of people who had your response to that. And purposely so.
Yeah, yeah.
Shakespeare wrote a play and there's a speech, to be or not to be. I think that scene is a to be or not
yep,
to be
yep.
scene.
Yep.
And if we knew whether or not we should be or not be, and it was an easy choice, then, you know, there's yep. nothing for us to do. We might as well go home. We continue to watch because we said, boy, this is difficult.
And you don't have to be a Danish prince or a Liberian refugee for that difficulty to hit home. For NPR News, I'm Dan Weissman in Chicago.
A 9-year-old boy is saved after his mother leaves him in a locked, airless apartment for a week. No food, water, or light. He breaks out through a window and police find him weak and bleeding. They find his mother passed out in a crack house nearby. But that boy, Anton, winds up in the hearts and arms of the Colemans, a prominent political family, who rear him with all the advantages their name, wealth, and love can confer. He grows up to be a man of character and distinction, and then discovers the truth. Everybody's Son is the new novel by Thriti Umbregar, author of The Space Between Us and other acclaimed novels. She joins us now from the studios of WCPN in Cleveland. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure being here, Scott.
I purposely didn't mention, because the copy on the flap of your book doesn't really, that Anton and the parents who adopt him are of different races.
I noticed that.
Is the copy flap trying to accomplish something to lead people into the novel?
To be perfectly candid with you, I had not realized this until I heard your introduction, and I'm kind of proud of the fact that it doesn't. I'm just being very honest. I hadn't noticed that myself.
Help us understand the story. The Colemans are David and Dolores Coleman, and they take Anton into their family as a foster son. They're not both in agreement at first, are they?
No, not at all. They have lost their own biological son several years prior to when the novel opens. I don't think either one of them has really had an extended conversation about whether they should, you know, permanently adopt another child.
Mm-hmm.
Each seems to think that they are giving the other what they want or what they secretly desire. So In some sense, they have kind of blundered their way into fostering Anton. And then what ends up happening, of course, is that David sees the untapped potential in Anton and convinces himself in that self-delusionary way that human beings often operate, that he only wants to permanently have custody of Anton because it's in the boy's best interest, and sort of conveniently ignores the fact that it is also what his heart desires.
I read the bare bones of the plot premise, obviously, in the introduction, but Anton's mother, Juanita, has an explanation for what's happened that's better than those bare facts, doesn't she?
Yes, very much so. One of the things that it was very important to me to convey in this novel is that despite the fact of her addiction, Juanita is actually a very good mom. And the paradox of this whole situation is nobody else seems to know that except for her son himself, who is, of course, her victim. And yet the court system, you know, the police, and certainly David Coleman himself, all seem to think of her as a very bad mother, which arguably in some ways she is, because all said and done, she does abandon her son for a week.
And crack addiction is not... is rarely associated with good parenting.
Yes, exactly. Precisely so. And yet, none of Anton's parents, you know, everybody in some ways is a flawed character, but they are all at least convincing themselves that they are acting in the boy's best interests.
When did this story begin in your mind, and what put it there, do you think?
It's very strange, Scott. I kid you not. The entire book kind of presented itself to me in a span of maybe 15 to 30 seconds. It felt like, you know, some carpet like unfurling in front of me. But having said that, no book exists in a vacuum, right? It always exists in some kind of a larger context. So, of course, this is when the whole Black Lives Matter movement was ascendant. Mm-hmm. This was also in the waning years of the Obama presidency. You know, all these things were swirling around, not just in my head, but also in the body politic, so to speak.
Yeah. Tweedy, did you hesitate at all trying to write a novel about a white family who adopted an African-American son because you're from neither community, or did that not matter, or is that why you did it?
You know, Scott, I certainly did not write this novel to be provocative or inflammatory in any way. To be perfectly honest with you, I did not spend a lot of time debating whether I had the moral or even the literary authority to write the book. I mean, heck, if people can write about UFOs and space aliens, why the heck can't I write a novel about somebody who happens to be from a different race? You know, it is an undeniable fact that I was born and lived in India until I was 21. But it is also true that I've spent my entire adult life in the United States. And If you're casting around for an American topic to write about that reflects accurately, you know, my life in the last 30 years, what more quintessentially American topic than race and race relations, you know? But if you look at my entire body of work, Scott, every book that I've written in some ways deals with the issue of power. You know, who has power, who uses it against whom? For what reason? Now, having said all that, I mean, clearly, when you're writing about a community that's not yours, a culture that is not yours, you know, it comes with great responsibility. And that's a responsibility that I take seriously. So you can bet that I did my research. You can bet that I was trying not to indulge in stereotypes of any kind. But the last thing I want to do as a writer is tell the same story over and over again. You know, I want to tell stories about the country that I now call mine and call home.
Tweedy Umurgar, her novel, Everybody's Son. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. It was truly a pleasure talking to you.
Ready for some new music? Well, it's time to check in with a few public radio DJs to hear what they have in heavy rotation.
Hi, this is Cindy House. I am a host at Folk Alley and also the Morning Mix host at WYEP in Pittsburgh.
Sometimes when the world is empty, I go riding back on all the old roads.
Something that we're really into now is Deb Talon's new song, Bring Water. Deb Talon is one half of the Weepies, and this is her first solo album in 13 years. It's been since 2004. Had three kids with her husband and musical partner, Steve Tannen. She also survived some pretty serious breast cancer. She had stage 3 breast cancer, and it caused her to sort of lose pieces of her identity. And in order to gain it all back, she began working on this album, Lucky Girl.
Something's on fire, bring water, bring water.
The line, bring water, something's on fire, bring water, that must be my heart. Just pure poetry from Deb Talman.
Bring water, bring water. Something's on fire, bring water.
I'm Micah Schweitzer. I'm one of the hosts for Wyoming Sounds, located in Laramie, Wyoming.
My big black man.
I've been seized by Otis Taylor's new release.
Got dog, dog eyes.
And the song that I'm highlighting is called 12 String Mile.
Big, big man. Got dog, dog skin. Nobody sees me.
What I love about Otis Taylor is that he does what he calls trance blues, which means that oftentimes he's hanging out for a whole song with like one or two chords, creating these moody, repetitive grooves. On top of that, or within that, he's able to create space for these really evocative lyrics, and he's able to talk about oftentimes really difficult subjects.
One more mile to go. Nobody sees me.
4 years ago in 2013, he came out with another great album called My World Is Gone. That one tackled the treatment of Native Americans by the U.S. government. And I think, well, who wants to listen to such difficult songs, especially like as your summertime jam? But it pulls you in physically.
Nobody sees me. Nobody sees me.
Hey, I'm Talia Schlanger. I host the World Cafe, and my heavy rotation pick is a song called Moonshine Freeze by This Is The Kick.
As the change sets in, we are separate. As the game begins, we are separate.
Okay, isn't that right off the bat the kind of sound that you want to take a bath in? Like you just want to let it wash over you.
Cycles of three, triangles are tricky. Cycles of three.
And Moonshine Freeze is apparently based on a clapping game for kids where you say the word moonshine three times and then you freeze.
Moonshine, moonshine, moonshine. Freeze, moonshine, moonshine, moonshine. Freeze, moonshine, moonshine, moonshine.
So you hear her using the game there to repeat moonshine three times. And earlier she refers to triangles. And I don't know, I've never thought about it this way before until I heard this song, but triangles may be the unsung heroes of shapes. Triangle is the delta symbol, and in math or science it represents change. And Kate uses it here in this really interesting way in a song that is about change and about threes, triangles.
We are found again as the change sets in. Cycles of three, moonshine, 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 free. Cycles of three, moonshine, moonshine, moonshine.
You can hear more music, and we hope you will, in Heavy Rotation on our website, nprmusic.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from EBSCO, studying how people use information and developing technologies and resources to create greater access to content. EBSCO employs developers, subject experts, and librarians. Learn more at careers.ebsco.com. From the Joyce Foundation, working to ensure that all students arrive at kindergarten ready to learn and graduate high school prepared to succeed in college, work, and life. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is WBUR. It's 57 degrees in Boston as Weekend Edition continues at 9 o'clock.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Israeli Stage, Days of Atonement, a provocative drama with guest appearance by WBUR's Bob Oakes, through June 25th at the Calderwood Pavilion, IsraeliStage.com. Touch Tomorrow at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, a free family festival of science, technology, and robots, June 10th. More at tt.wpi.edu. And Cohen Media Group, presenting the new film Churchill, The Untold Story of D-Day, starring Brian Cox, Miranda Richardson, and John Slattery, now playing in theaters everywhere.
Hi, it's Robin Young. Thanks to listener support, WBUR brings fact-based, independent news to our community every day. If you've already given to WBUR, ask your employer to match your gift by June 9th, and you could win season tickets for 6 of Lexus Broadway in Boston's upcoming shows, including Hamilton. To learn more or to give, go to WBUR.org/match, and thanks. From Boston University, this is 90.9 WBUR Boston, 92.7 WBUA Tisbury, and 89.1 WBUH Brewster. Online at WBUR.org and the new WBUR Listen app for iPhone and Android. WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. Sherry Stone's the daughter of a man put to death for murder, but he was on death row for more than 30 years, his execution delayed 7 times. Sherry Stone says,
there's the family of the victim and there's the family of the convicted. We both go through cruel and unusual punishment to a whole different kind of degree. And that is not fair to the families.
Later this hour, the effect of justice delayed again and again. Gail Godwin's new novel about a little boy and an old ghost. And hey, I got a studio next to the barn. Let's put on a show. The birthplace of public radio. First, our newscast. It's Saturday, June 3rd, 2017.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. In Afghanistan, explosions today at a funeral of one of several people killed in yesterday's protests. The blasts have reportedly killed at least a dozen people and injured many others. Across town, demonstrations continue after the truck bombing that killed more than 80 people and injured more than 400 earlier this week. Jennifer Glass reports.
Demonstrations against the Afghan government continue under two colorful tents set up in the middle of what is typically a busy intersection in Kabul's Shahri Now neighborhood. Even though it's a working day, this part of the city, usually bustling, is quiet, except for several hundred protesters gathered in the street. Dozens of police and security forces have blocked off roads and are searching demonstrators as they enter the site. On Friday, protests turned violent, with at least 4 civilians killed. The police allege some protesters were carrying guns and that their officers fired at the crowd in self-defense. The demonstrators want the government to step down for failing to provide security in the wake of Wednesday's truck bombing, one of the worst since 2001. For NPR News, I'm Jennifer Glass in Kabul.
Defense Secretary James Mattis praising China for working with the U.S. to help restrain North Korea. He spoke today at an annual security conference in Singapore, and while he praised China, he also said the Trump administration will continue calling out Beijing over its activity in the South China Sea. International concern over President Trump's decision to pull the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord. NPR's Windsor Johnson reports that several nations vowing to join forces to preserve the pact.
China, Germany, France, and India are among the world nations pledging to uphold the Paris Accord, a non-binding commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The president on Thursday said the international agreement undermines the U.S. economy and weakens national sovereignty. But Terry Madonna, political science professor at Franklin and Marshall College, says Trump's decision only isolates the U.S. from its allies.
It adds another thorn into the problem of trying to work collectively with our allies, whether it's NATO, the European Union. It's damaging in some respects around the world.
Nearly 200 countries signed the Paris Accord in 2015. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
The former leader of Britain's UK Independence Party, Nigel Farage, denying allegations that the FBI has contacted him as part of its investigation into Russian influence in the presidential campaign. Philip Marks is in London.
The man that President Trump as a candidate called Mr. Brexit has pushed back against a Guardian newspaper report that he was an FBI person of interest because of his links to the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. WikiLeaks published damaging documents from the Clinton campaign, a major element in the FBI investigation. Mr. Farage said the accusations were a total fabrication, and he'd met with Mr. Assange just once.
And you're listening to NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Sharon Brody in Boston.
Former Secretary of State John Kerry continues to harshly criticize President Trump for his decision to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. Kerry denounces it as craven ignorance. In a CNN interview, Kerry says the president does not understand the dangers of climate change.
There is not one single peer-reviewed study that says it's a hoax.
Well, you know,
and yet we have a president and members of a party who keep citing the fact that there isn't enough evidence or that this is a hoax.
As a candidate, Trump questioned the science on the consequences of greenhouse gases. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders told the Boston Globe that Kerry sounds unhinged and is out of touch with everyday hardworking Americans. Boston's Roman Catholic Cardinal Sean O'Malley is expressing disappointment in President Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement. And O'Malley says he hopes the administration reconsiders the decision. On his blog, O'Malley cites the teachings of Pope Francis. He also quotes a top bishop in the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops who called the president's move deeply troubling, especially because of the potential to hurt people in the poorest and most vulnerable communities. The state is asking healthcare providers to watch for more possible cases of mumps in Boston, Chelsea, and Revere. The Massachusetts Department of Public Health says since the end of March, 12 mumps cases have been reported among adults from Colombia, the Dominican Republic, Guatemala, and El Salvador. In sports, last night in Baltimore, the Red Sox lost to the Orioles 3-2. They play again tonight. Tonight at Gillette, the Revs host Toronto. A chance of showers today in Boston. Thunderstorms are possible this afternoon and highs today in the mid-60s. It is 62 degrees now in Boston. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by GEICO, protecting people and their vehicles for over 75 years. GEICO is proud to offer car insurance and more to Massachusetts drivers, too. Additional information at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO. That's 1-800-947-AUTO. And Novo Nordisk, working to defeat diabetes for more than 90 years through prevention, diagnosis, and treatment. More at novonordisk.us.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. President Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord this week. More reports of possible connections between the Trump administration and Russia, and James Comey is set to sing next week. Joining us now, NPR's ineffable Ron Elving. Somebody put that in the script, senior political editor and correspondent. I suspect it was Ron. How are you, Ron?
I'm fine, Scott, and I promise not to sing.
Ineffable as always. Oh, or what you're doing. So at least you know the lyrics. President Trump announced the U.S., of course, is going to leave the Paris Agreement. Other major leaders around the world said they're disappointed. A couple said they're not inclined to renegotiate a pact that took 10 years to reach. The president repeated that he wants to put America first. Does his announcement accomplish what he wanted to this week?
Yes, what he wanted to accomplish this week. He wanted to resolve a big conflict inside his White House and his larger political family, quite literally family. You know, you've got globalists on one hand who would just as soon get out of this agreement, and then you have nationalists. Mm-hmm. The globalists want to stay in the agreement, of course, mm-hmm. and the nationalists who wanted to get out. And here we're talking about, you use the phrase, America first. And this is the crowd that is very inspired by that kind of rhetoric. Now, whether on the long-term hand it's going to produce the economic effects that are desired and promised, like bringing back coal jobs, for instance, that's going to take some time to tell.
It's going to take years for the withdrawal to go into effect. And I wonder, does the president's decision mobilize climate change as an issue in 2020 in a way that it hasn't seemed to register with voters before?
Well, you're right about the past. It doesn't seem to reach people the way, say, healthcare does or Social Security as an issue. But it is a potent symbol. And that is, in fact, what Trump wants it to be. He wants it to be a symbol, a signal, if you will, of change of direction for the U.S. and a gesture to the world. And, of course, for people who are disturbed by that particular gesture, this could be a potent symbol as well and a political inspiration.
Forgive me, you mean like a Mr. Met type gesture?
Well, a gesture that people will not have any trouble interpreting.
All right. The climate agreement headlines rose to the top of the news by the end of the week, but, of course, there are more news about alleged links with Russia. especially involving the president's son-in-law and point man on so many issues, Jared Kushner. There'll be investigations. It'll take a lot of time. But what do you see that might be involved here?
We are still trying to figure out just what kind of fire is causing all of this smoke. And this latest Kushner element is different and perhaps the most serious yet. We have a new character in the story in Sergei Gorkov, apparently a close associate of Vladimir Putin, very high up in the political world, the intelligence community, the banking in Russia, who came to the United States, had a secret meeting with Jared Kushner about setting up a back channel for communications between the Trump operation and the Russians, which Russians we're not entirely sure, but he has a lot of associations. And these would not be monitored by U.S. intelligence. So then apparently this individual, Gorkov, went back to Russia to meet with Putin. And we all have to ask, what was that all about? And Kushner's lawyer says he's eager to talk. We don't know just when and just how, but we are very much looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm. And of course, as we mentioned, former head of the FBI, James Comey, is set to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee next week. First, any chance that President Trump will invoke executive privilege to try and prevent him from doing that?
He could try, but Comey no longer works for him. He is out. He is a private citizen, and he wants to talk. So the next step for the president would be to pressure the Senate leadership to either withdraw the invitation to Comey to speak or shut down the investigation altogether, either one of which would be extraordinary and set off a lot of alarm bells.
Yeah. What kind of milestone does this potentially represent?
Potentially, it could be a turning point for the entire investigation. This kind of testimony does not always make history, but sometimes it changes the course of history in respect to a particular investigation.
NPR's Ryan Elving, thanks so much. And listen, my friend, we're going to be out of the D.C. bubble next week, aren't we?
We are indeed.
We're going to do our show from the stage of the Lyric Theater in Birmingham. You'll be with us. I'm so glad. See you then. Take care.
See you then. I'm very eager to get back to Birmingham.
A shoving match that included death threats between state lawmakers in Texas went viral this week. But before things got physical in the Capitol, the politicians working there were already angry, and some put the blame on a small group of conservative lawmakers. From member station KUT in Austin, Ben Philpott reports.
They call themselves the Texas Freedom Caucus. The name, of course, is inspired by the group of far-right conservatives in the U.S. House who have played an oversized role in running Congress. And just like at the federal level, the 12 members of the Texas Caucus have shifted the debate in the Texas House to the right.
This discussion and my opposition to this bill has been on one simple thing: whether this should be handled by the government or should be handled by communities and individuals.
That's Republican State Representative Jonathan Stickland. The caucus ties all of its arguments to freedom, liberty, and limited government. There are similar groups popping up in legislatures across the country, and their principles play well on the campaign trail in deep red states like Texas. But Republican State House member Jason Villalba says it makes governing harder.
That sounds great in a soundbite, but in the end, what does that mean? That means that people aren't getting school lunches and that research isn't being done and that schools aren't funded and that children go hungry. That's what that means.
And the tactics used by the Texas Freedom Caucus have angered many lawmakers. First, the caucus used legislative rules to kill off uncontroversial bills. Then it was on to amending major legislation with far-right principles. That pushed lawmakers to a simmering boil. Then, when a bill on immigration and local law enforcement came up, Freedom Caucus member Matt Schaefer added a provision to allow anyone detained by police to be questioned about their immigration status.
That when the police are doing their work, and as part of that, they are inquiring into this person's identity, and they learn that the person has, for instance, a federal detainer, that they can honor that.
For Democrats, it was the breaking point. That anger fueled this week's skirmish on the House floor when a member of the Freedom Caucus told Hispanic Democrats he had called federal immigration officials on protesters at the Capitol. Some fellow Republicans also complain about the group, but in the end, the vast majority have voted with the Freedom Caucus. State Rep. Jason Villalba did so less enthusiastically because it meant taking votes that could be used against him in the primaries.
And the primaries are going to be voted by people who are very strident in their political beliefs, and so you have to be careful that you don't offend the primary voters, even though the people at large probably aren't in favor of something.
Villalba says the drive for ideological purity will make it tougher for more moderate Texas Republicans to win re-election. And in a brief moment of bipartisanship, Democrats agree. They're hoping the Freedom Caucus's tactics will help them win seats in 2018. For NPR News, I'm Ben Philpott in Austin.
Police in the Philippines say that Friday's attack on a casino complex in Manila that killed 38 people, including the gunman, was not an act of terrorism. The Islamic State claims otherwise. The Philippine government has a history of downplaying the threat posed by Islamic extremists, but last week's occupation of a Filipino city by IS-linked militants makes that harder. Michael Sullivan reports from Manila.
The attack occurred just after midnight at Resorts World Manila, a high-end, high-profile complex just a few blocks from the international airport. After several hours of chaos, National Police Chief Ronald De La Rosa told reporters at the scene it was over.
The lone gunman is already neutralized.
A lone gunman, he said, who apparently died after setting himself on fire in a hotel room. The 37 others, police say, died from smoke inhalation. De La Rosa insisted it was not an act of terrorism because the man didn't shoot anybody. Analyst Sidney Jones isn't convinced.
I think it was pretty clear once the military operations intensified in Marawi that the ISIS coalition would look for other targets.
Jones tracks Southeast Asia militant groups at the Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict in Jakarta, Indonesia. Even if the government's version of events holds, she doesn't expect it's going to be long before Manila is targeted. And she's not alone.
The threat to Manila is very significant because there are many armed groups that have pledged allegiance to IS in the Philippines. Any of those groups can stage such an attack.
Rohan Gunaratnam heads the International Center for Political Violence and Terrorism in Singapore.
Until those groups are contained, isolated, and eliminated, the threat to the Philippines, including to the capital of Manila, will remain significant.
And what Sidney Jones calls the euphoria on social media about the ongoing fight between IS-linked militants and government forces in the southern city of Marawi is likely to attract more foreign fighters from Indonesia, from Malaysia, and perhaps beyond. Despite martial law on the island of Mindanao, despite stepped-up security at ports and airports.
And then I think it's going to be a question about when the Duterte government realizes they've got an ideological problem on their hands that won't necessarily be solved by military force. And I don't think they're prepared for that.
For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Manila.
Ireland's center-right Fine Gael party has elected Leo Varadkar as its leader, and therefore next prime minister. He'll be Ireland's youngest leader at 38. He's the son of an Irish nurse and a doctor from Mumbai. He told the party conference, "When my father traveled 5,000 miles to build a new home in Ireland, I doubt he ever dreamed his son would grow up to be its leader." Mr. Varadkar is also gay. He was a doctor like his father before entering politics and was elected to Parliament, then Minister of Health. Leo Varadkar is considered a free market economic conservative who says, "I want to dedicate ourselves to building a republic of opportunity." The next prime minister of Ireland is a 38-year-old Indian gay conservative. Only in America. Oh, wait.
This is 90.9 WBUR. It is 62 degrees in Boston at 9:18. Coming up on Weekend Edition Saturday, Gail Godwin talks about her new book, Grief Cottage. Join WBUR and The Artery today at the free Cambridge Arts River Festival. You can enjoy music, theater, food, interactive family activities, and much more. Details at wbur.org/events.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the BSO. Hear Beatles and other rock music hosted by WZLX Breakfast with the Beatles host, Chachi Lapret, June 8th, 10th, and 11th, bostonpops.org. The law firm of Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, counsel to leading companies and institutions for more than a century. Client-focused, collaborative, this is Nutter. Online at nutter.com. And DCU, Digital Federal Credit Union, where you can switch your credit card for a low-rate DCU credit card. What can DCU save you? DCU.org.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. Several people are reported dead in a string of explosions in the Afghan capital. The blasts appeared to target the funeral of a protester who was killed in clashes with police yesterday. Demonstrators are demanding better security after Wednesday's devastating truck bombing. Defense Secretary James Mattis says the Trump administration is encouraged by China's renewed commitment to reining in North Korea. But in his remarks at a security conference in Singapore, he was critical of Chinese actions in disputed areas of the South China Sea. And there's been no claim of responsibility in the hacking of the Twitter account of Bahrain's foreign minister, but suspicion is falling on Shiite militants. Hackers took control of the account today and posted a series of threats to Bahrain's royal family. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the belief that all lives have equal value and working with partners to help envision a world where every person has the opportunity to live a healthy, productive life at gatesfoundation.org. From the Wallace Foundation, fostering improvements in learning and enrichment for disadvantaged children and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas at wallacefoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Tommy Arthur was put to death by the state of Alabama last week after his execution had been stayed 7 times over the years. He pleaded guilty to the murder of his sister-in-law, Eloise West, in the 1970s and was on work release in 1982, when a man named Troy Wicker was shot to death in his bed in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Prosecutors said that Tommy Arthur was sleeping with Judy Wicker and agreed to shoot her husband for $10,000. Tommy Arthur always said he was innocent. He was convicted and sentenced to death 7 times. His execution was scheduled, then stayed by appeals, until he was put to death on May 25th. His daughter, Sherry Stone, was at his execution, and she joins us now from member station WUSF in Tampa, Florida. Ms. Stone, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
I gather you were a teenager when your father was arrested.
Yes, 15 years old.
Well, what was he like as a father?
It was pretty bad, actually. Pretty violent. Alcohol, lots of abuse in the home towards our stepmother, mothers, us. It was pretty bad.
Yeah. So a number of years ago, I gather you decided to look into your father's case. What did you find?
Well, that's a lot. We're covering 40 years of stuff. But when I was 15, he was arrested. Then he got out on work release and seemed to have changed and was doing really well. Then when he was arrested the second time, my first instinct was he was guilty, no doubt. Mm-hmm. And then about 15 years ago, I started really looking into the case. And what I found was astounding. Mm-hmm. I could not find the evidence to prove him guilty. And I started digging and digging. I mean, it really consumed me for many years.
Well, there were no eyewitnesses, no DNA test.
It didn't exist back then. Yeah. DNA testing did not exist. There was plenty of evidence, but none of it connects him to this crime. There's no physical evidence. Fingerprints that were there do not match him. There were no eyewitnesses. Now, there is physical evidence available to be DNA tested and has never been done so.
Yeah. We can't, obviously, relitigate the case.
No, a little too late for that.
I do want to ask you about what the effect of those 7 stays were, because I gather you went to the prison almost every time.
It's something that you really can't put into words other than just agonizing. You get there, you prepare for it, you make funeral arrangements, you do the obituary, you go through all the stages as if someone has died, and then they don't. And, I'm not the only one's going through that. The victim's family goes through this as well. You do get angry, about a lot of things, but, there's not a whole lot you can really do about it except speak about it and hopefully make some type of change in some kind of way. I'd like to see mandatory DNA testing. And
you've called for that to be done, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to be involved in it, but the death penalty itself really doesn't serve a lot of purpose. And I publicly, over 40 years, never took a stance over whether I was for it or against it. But if we are going to continue with it, then we need to make some changes in the legal procedures that are currently in place.
You were there at the end, I gather.
I was. I witnessed the execution, and it did not go down the way the state-selected witnesses said. I think everyone in that room wanted him, including the attorneys, wanted him to just drift off peacefully. But I definitely knew something was wrong. The first drug that was administered did not make him unconscious. He sat straight up twice and said, "My eyes are burning." And he was jerking left to right. And I said, "Something's wrong." And inside the chamber, one person did see something was wrong and went over, pinched him, said his name. By this time, he's laying back. He's breathing very heavy, very irregular. His hands go up into a curled position. And what is supposed to take under 10 minutes took 30 minutes. And when the curtains closed, I really wasn't sure if he was dead or not because the hands had never relaxed.
You've always, near as I can tell, spoken with such understanding for the Wicker family. I wonder if you've had any personal encounters with them.
I had met Judy many years ago, but, you know, the children and the family, no, I have not. They were at the execution, but we were seated in different rooms. But they've expressed they felt sorry for me as well. And I have the deepest sympathy, and I really, really sincerely hope that the execution allows them some sort of peace and closure, because I know how much, as a family member, no matter which side you're on, that's something that is desired more than anything. Yeah. You just want that closure.
Sherry Stone in Tampa, Florida, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
The trip across Mexico is notoriously dangerous for Central American migrants seeking asylum. Extortion, violence, immigration raids are common. If they make it to the U.S. border, they can spend weeks, months, and even years in detention. Reporter Jesse Hardman recently met up with a caravan of Central Americans who are trying a strength-in-numbers approach to fleeing the troubles back home.
Around 100 migrants, soaked by a morning rain, pack onto the third floor of a cafe in Tijuana, Mexico. They're practicing what they'll say a few hours from now when they walk en masse to the United States border. "I'm afraid to return to my country. I have the right to an asylum interview," they shout.
"They're coming because they're threatened by organized crime and political oppression."
Gabriela Cortez Lopez is part of a migrant rights coalition called the Refugee Caravan. The group's been helping these asylum seekers, who range in age from a few months to 70, make their way across Mexico on foot, by train, and in vans. "It's a forced migration," Cortez Lopez says. The refugee caravan organizers provided food, transit, and protection along the way. They also shared legal advice, like making sure people have evidence to back up their asylum claims. 44-year-old Honduran Iris Samador traveled thousands of miles clutching her documents.
"I have the death certificates for my husband and my son that show that they were violently assassinated."
Amador fled with her 6 and 8-year-old daughters in tow. The trio holds hands as they walk with the rest of their migrant group the last 20 minutes to the border. As darkness falls, the asylum seekers slowly disappear into the U.S. border office.
"Under this administration, with this many people, to my knowledge, this is the first time this has been attempted."
Melanie Gleason is a Tucson-based immigration rights attorney. She helped caravan members organize their cases. Gleason says she wishes these asylum claims could reference the fact the U.S. has historically supported the very things these people are fleeing. Civil wars, economic meddling, and
the CIA-led coup in Guatemala.
That's the country Miguel Castillo, Wendy Kobach, and their four-year-old son Angel just fled. Castillo witnessed a robbery at his work. Shortly after, armed men began shooting at his house and his family, he says.
No podemos regresar porque nos matarían.
We can't go back because they'll kill us.
After making their way to the Guatemala-Mexico border, Castillo and his son Angel were recruited to join the refugee caravan.
You question the authenticity or the legitimacy of these claims.
Robert Law is a D.C.-based lawyer and government relations director for the Federation for American Immigration Reform. Law says he's sympathetic to struggles in Central America, but many people fleeing those countries don't meet U.S. asylum standards.
It's more of a generalized fear of violence and lack of opportunities that is causing someone to come to the United States.
Miguel Castillo's request for an asylum hearing was granted. He credits the refugee caravan for preparing him to deal with weeks in detention and the tough questions he got from immigration officials. Now he and his son are staying with family on the West Coast.
I can't walk around totally free yet, but I'm more relaxed at least.
Castillo wears an ankle monitoring bracelet as he waits for his formal asylum hearing. No dates have been set yet. Castillo's already survived substantial hurdles to get to this point. He knows there will be more. For NPR News, I'm Jesse Hardman in Los Angeles.
And now it's time for sports. The NBA Finals are underway. The Golden State Warriors did a job on the Cleveland Cavaliers in the first game, but hey, there are four, five, six, 7 games to come, maybe. We're joined now by ESPN's Howard Bryant. Good morning, Howard.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Warriors, Cavs, blah, blah, blah. Same
and
championship.
Warriors,
Cavs. Warriors, Cavs. To you, my friend. These two teams have been utterly dominant for a couple of years now. What do you make of the kvetching we hear from some commentators that dominant teams are bad for basketball?
I think people like to complain, and I think that people don't really have a great grasp of NBA history. I think, one, if you remember how fantastic the playoffs were last season, when you had the Oklahoma City Thunder up 3-1, and Golden State came back and won that series, and then Golden State was up 3-1, and then Cleveland came back and won that series. Everybody at the end of that series, at the end of Game 7, said, let's do it again. And let's just start these two teams playing right now. And so then both teams do what they're supposed to do. And we get here, and now people are saying, oh, this is boring. It makes no sense. I don't know, Scott. I watch sports all the time. I think I'd like to see the two best teams play for a championship. I don't think it's that controversial. And also, I think when you watch the NBA, anybody who's ever watched the NBA throughout its history, it's always been dominated by a few teams. The Celtics and the Lakers have combined for 33 championships, and the league's only been around since 1946.
Let's not forget the Bulls. Listen.
oh, you mean the Bulls that have won with Michael Jordan and dominated the entire decade of the 90s? Absolutely.
Yeah, those are the guys I mean.
Those
and
guys.
I think it makes a championship mean more.
Well, absolutely it does. And I think, and I don't like diluted leagues. I don't like forced parity through salary caps and these other things. Build an organization. Give me the best teams. Let me watch them win. That's all I care about.
LeBron James had to contend with something off the court this week. Somebody spray painted a racial slur across the entrance to his Los Angeles home. Here's what he had to say.
No matter how much money you have, no matter how famous you are, no matter how many people admire you, being black in America is... it's tough. And we got a long way to go for us as a society and for us as African Americans until we feel equal in America.
I'm so impressed by how compelling and outspoken LeBron James is. What do you make of his response?
Well, I thought it was pretty unremarkable, to be honest. I thought that everything that he said, as much as he's getting all kinds of accolades for it, it's basic. And I think I was very obviously impressed with LeBron. Me personally, I don't like when we have to when these players go through this, when Adam Jones went through what he went through in Boston, and we end up asking the black guy what he felt about what happened to him. I would much rather have interviews with people from his neighborhood this happened. Why are we asking him as if he did it to himself? I'm much more interested in hearing from his neighbors and his residents in that Brentwood neighborhood, because I think it defines them far more than it defines him. He didn't do anything.
We have half a minute left for the Stanley Cup playoffs. The Penguins are up over the Predators 2-0. Nothing. Great country stars have been singing the national anthem in Nashville, but do they have a chance?
And as usual, Scott, you were slighting the Nashville Predators just because they swept your Chicago Blackhawks in the first round.
Oh, I'd forgotten that.
Yes. I think it's going to be still a great series. You got 2 games at home for Nashville. It's not over, but once again, these are the defending champion Penguins, and they are the signature team. It's going to be a tough climb for the Predators.
Yeah. Howard Bryant of ESPN and ESPN The Magazine, thanks so much for being with us, Howard.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. The pace of hiring in the United States slowed last month, but the unemployment rate dropped to 4.3%, the lowest it's been in 16 years. The monthly employment snapshot from the Labor Department is one of the most closely watched indicators of the health of the economy. NPR's Scott Horsley reports, no matter what the numbers say, how we feel about them is often colored by politics.
For the first time in a decade, most Americans feel good about the U.S. economy. A survey this spring by the Pew Research Center found nearly 6 in 10 think the economy's in good shape. That's up 14 points from a year ago. Nearly all of the gain has come from Republicans, who are now twice as likely to say the economy's doing well as they were last year, even though Chief Economist Nariman Berevish of IHS Market says actual conditions haven't budged much.
There's no big change in the economy. Clearly, the change is the election and the politics, and obviously there's some people who like what happened and some who don't. The politics is sort of outweighing the economics.
You see a dramatic display of that in Wisconsin, where surveys before and after the November election found a stark partisan flip-flop in economic expectations. Charles Franklin, who conducts the poll for Marquette Law School, says Democrats are now much more pessimistic about the economy than they were before the election, while Republicans are more than 3 times as likely to think the economy is going to get better.
There's nothing irrational in partisans believing that a change of government will dramatically improve the outlook of the economy.
But the election didn't just change people's expectations for the future. It also changed their feelings about the recent past. President Trump had been in office less than 2 months when Franklin conducted his most recent survey, and already 4 times as many Republicans said the economy had gotten better in the last year than said so last October.
It's really hard to see how people change their views of the past, except that our perceptions of the economy are filtered through partisan lenses.
When he was running for president, Trump often dismissed encouraging economic indicators as phony. Now he celebrates every positive bit of news.
Absolutely tremendous economic progress since Election Day on November 8th. The economy is starting to come back, and very, very rapidly.
Franklin says it's long been the case that Americans are more satisfied when their party controls the White House. But the trend lines for both Democrats and Republicans used to go up and down together in response to real-world conditions. Over the last dozen years or so, though, those lines have come untethered from one another. Partisan differences now seem to carry more weight than our shared national experience.
How do you have responsive politics if, in fact, the public is seeing two such different worlds?
And, Franklin says, much of this partisan filtering is not even conscious.
It'd be one thing if we put on rose-colored glasses and we knew we were doing it. But I'm afraid with a lot of political perceptions, the color of our glasses is something we don't even think about. And when the party in control switches, we switch the shade of our glasses without really much consideration of that.
Those partisan lenses probably wouldn't blind people to another deep recession, nor a genuine boom. But so long as the economy is chugging along in fits and starts, there's lots of room for partisan interpretation. Scott Horsley, NPR News, The White House. We'll be right back.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Sharon Brody. Democrats are gathering in Worcester for a convention to vote on the state party platform. Proposals include calling for a single-payer health system, a $15 minimum wage, and free tuition at state universities and colleges. Former Secretary of State and former Senator John Kerry is continuing his harsh criticism of President Trump for the decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. The Massachusetts Democrat tells CNN the move is the result of craven ignorance. Kerry says Trump and other Republicans who've questioned the science are ignoring peer-reviewed research. The state is recommending you seek alternate routes to avoid a stretch of the Mass Pike in Boston this weekend. The Pike is reduced to two lanes in each direction with barriers in place between Alston-Brighton and the Beacon Street overpass. The state's testing how traffic will flow next month in August during a major repair project on the Comav Bridge. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Fidelity Investments, reminding you it's never too early to start saving for your child's future. Learn more about a tax-advantaged 529 college savings account and how you can use the money to pay for qualified expenses at fidelity.com/ufund. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE SIPC. And the Harvard Art Museums with the Philosophy Chamber, a reimagination of one of the cultural landmarks of revolutionary New England, on view for the first time in 200 years.
In a world of change, it's more important than ever to focus on the facts and what's at stake. You can rely on WBUR, Boston's NPR news station, to keep you grounded, informed, and inspired to remain curious and to dig deeper with coverage of issues from around the world and around the corner. WBUR is your go-to source for the latest news, podcasts, stories, and more. It's your world, our future.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. And from Eli Lilly and Company, striving to unite caring with discovery to make life better. Working to discover life-changing medicines in the areas of diabetes, cancer, and Alzheimer's disease. At lillyforbetter.com.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. One of the oldest radio stations in this country celebrates its 100th birthday this year. Wisconsin Public Radio and WHAAM helped develop the framework for the public radio system we're familiar with today, so we asked WPR's Maureen McCollum to tell us about her station's legacy.
By the second decade of the 20th century, a lot of people were experimenting with wireless radio transmissions, though most of it was in Morse code. But in early 1917, University of Wisconsin physics professor Earl Terry wanted to try something else. Broadcasting audio.
He'd been working with the technology and knew what a big deal this was, what its value was.
Former Wisconsin Public Radio host Randall Davidson wrote a book on the history of the station. He says Professor Terry invited the who's who of Madison over, turned on the radio in his living room, while a colleague on campus dropped the needle on a version of this song.
I think the other academics that were with him, even people in his department, didn't realize what an important thing this was to be able to transmit sound.
Even though this was one of the first over-the-air broadcasts of audio, most people didn't see the use. The few who had radios at the time used them to receive time checks and weather forecasts via Morse code.
So people would tune in to get these time signals to synchronize their watches and clocks and so forth, and then you could tune down and get the weather forecast. And that's pretty much your broadcast listening for the day.
It was mostly farmers who were deciphering these Morse code signals from a handful of stations in the Midwest. Most stations went dark during World War I. But what became known as WHA continued broadcasting for the military in Wisconsin. In 1921, 3 years after the war ended,
we started doing a regular daily broadcast over the noon hour of weather and farm markets.
These audio reports lasted for decades.
It's 12:30. The College of Agriculture presents the Midday Farm Program.
Here's an example from 1960.
We wouldn't be surprised to see robins with earmuffs or a tulip blossom filled with snow today in Madison,
or anywhere in Wisconsin, for that matter, on this cold, damp, and undecided May Monday.
In the 1920s and 30s, commercial radio stations across the country were playing music, drama, and public affairs programs. But as a non-commercial station, WHA had a specific educational mission and drew on the university's resources to create shows like the Homemakers Program.
Today we have with us in the studio an authority on one of Wisconsin's most important products, cheese.
WHA managers took that mission a step further after hearing children's programming on Chicago's NBC station. They created Wisconsin School of the Air.
That gay little tune, boys and girls, is the one that you're going to look forward to each week.
Kids sketched with Let's Draw.
I want you to remember real hard and draw for me a picture of the funniest thing that happened to you last summer.
They got creative with Let's Write.
Today is Cat Day. Well, you might say today that cats are our purpose. You'll pardon the pun, won't you?
Sure, it was cheesy, and sometimes it could be a bit boring, but WHA, along with stations in Ohio and Iowa, were considered innovators, says Josh Shepard. He's an assistant professor at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., and the director of the Library of Congress's Radio Preservation Task Force.
They started to make program transcriptions, they called them. Basically, they pressed records of programs, and then they would distribute them. So most of the best programming came out of Wisconsin because they actually were trying to match commercial aesthetics.
Shepard says these educational radio programs were precursors to what would become public radio. And one of the students singing and drawing along with WHA in his tiny country school in Madison was Bill Seemering.
Twice a day, the teacher would turn on the radio and we would listen to the Wisconsin School of the Air. So I learned art, music, nature studies, social studies, science, all by radio.
This had a huge impact on Seemering. He eventually went on to work at WHA in the 1950s. After that, he helped shape the sound of National Public Radio as its first program director in the 1970s.
Really, from the very beginning, it was the idea of using radio for social good.
Seemering gives a lot of credit to WHA for helping shape his philosophy at NPR. For example, he put women on the air, a rarity on the national level, but common in Wisconsin.
And, of course, we had a conversational style. It wasn't necessarily the voice of authority from New York, the white male. It would speak with many voices and many dialects to be inclusive.
Another WHA employee, Don Vegley, even composed the All Things Considered theme on a synthesizer in his Madison office. It's come a long way from this. But maybe not. For NPR News, I'm Maureen McCollum in Madison, Wisconsin.
Good legacy for us to try to live up to. Mexican-American singer Lila Downs says that she fell into a funk after the U.S. presidential elections. She says she's pulled herself out with her new album, which is called in English Salon, Tears, and Desire. It's a mix of traditional Mexican genres with a feminist beat. NPR's Carrie Kahn met up with the artist in Mexico City and sent us this report.
I wasn't alone in meeting Downs in Mexico City. She invited a dozen female journalists to an upscale restaurant to lunch and the launch of her new album.
Salud a todas. Salud, bienvenidas. Gracias por estar con nosotros un ratito.
Sporting her signature long braids and a traditional kitchen apron, Downs, now 48, raised a shot glass of Mexican mezcal spirits and toasted what she called a group of inspiring, peligrosa, dangerous women, a reference to a cut off her new album.
Me están saliendo cosas que no sabía que había en mí.
In this album, she tells the group in Spanish, things came out that I didn't even realize I had in me. Away from the group, Downs tells me she was surprised at how explicitly woman-centric her record turned out and how full of pain she was feeling about the new reality of politics in the U.S.
I think my wish and my dream was to make people come together and love each other a little bit more, you know, even though that sounds very hippie-like in these times. I actually do believe it can happen.
That hope and pain is felt throughout the traditional boleros, rancheros, cumbias, some infused with the blues, that make up the album, especially in this heart-wrenching opener, Urge.
Urge una persona que me arrulle entre sus.
that says, "With my pain, I am wandering around like a rolling stone, and all I need is for someone to listen to my triumphs and my failures." And I just found it so profound.
If fans are looking for the music with a message they've come to rely on with Downs, Felix Contreras of NPR Music's Alt Latino podcast says she delivers, especially in the album's dramatic Mexican rancheras.
The best ranchera composers just like really just wrote their songs in blood because it was just so tear your heart out dramatic. And that's what she goes for. You know, she is raised on that tradition.
It's not just the political reality in the U.S. that has touched Downs, but also the crime that is ripping through Mexico and the falsehoods she sings about in the cut La Mentira, The Lies.
Que me quieres a pesar de lo que dices, pues llevamos en el alma cicatrices.
This constant lie that we're living. Here, of course, in Mexico, but it's also happening every place, you know, corruption and impunity.
Down says she's out of her funk and moving forward, something she wants to inspire others to do through Salón Lágrimas y Deseo.
Hopefully, this provokes catharsis, and hopefully it makes us respond and react to what is happening to us in these times.
La vida es pura. Ya no me importa. Hay tantas cosas que quiero contigo que importan más.
Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Mexico City.
A stranger in the mind of an 11-year-old boy named Marcus gestures at an abandoned old home and tells him, "People who go in don't always come out." Now, do you think that'll keep that boy away from the house they call Grief Cottage? It's a ghost story. Set on an island off the coast of 1990 South Carolina and in the life of a little boy whose mother has died in a car accident and before she could tell him, it was his father. Grief Cottage is the latest novel from Gail Godwin, the critically acclaimed and best-selling novelist. She joins us now from Woodstock, New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
I'm so glad to be here.
What do they call the old house, Grief Cottage?
The locals on this small island call it that because 50 years ago in a hurricane, there was a family who came late in the season. It was October, hurricane season, and they never knew what happened to the family. The mother and the father and the boy just disappeared during the hurricane. Mm-hmm. So the cottage had a dark aura to it, and so they just called it Grief Cottage.
And of course, there's no way Marcus is going to stay away, is there?
Oh, no. If you were an 11-year-old boy with a bike and lots of time on your hand and you'd heard about this, of course you'd be going up there. And you'd probably be courting something to happen, even though you were terrified it might.
Is it okay to call this novel a ghost story?
Yes, it's a ghost story and it's a mind story. And it's a story about loneliness and loss and affection.
I want to ask you about, you have another character on the island, Coral Upchurch. She's 95. And
yes.
I wrote down what she tells little boy Marcus. She says, quote, "These days I have to put in requests to my brain as one does at the library. And then a little worker takes my slip and disappears into the stacks. It may take him a while, but he always comes back with the goods." I gather you're going to turn 80 in a few days.
Yes, and that Carl's experience came right from mine. As you get older, not only do you get more picky with your words, but you lose them. You used to have lots of servants, and you just pull the bell, like in Downton Abbey, and they'd all rush up with trays full of things. And now you pull the bell, and you wait for this very arthritic old butler who's your only servant left, and he comes up with his wooden tray, and there's one word on it, but it's a good word.
that's very vivid. Yeah.
But you know what? I'll tell you two good things that have happened to me this year.
Sure.
One is I've had an old school marm living in me all my writing life, and she has either retired or died. Her favorite mark of punctuation was the colon, because the colon says to the reader, stop, now I'm going to say something important. You may not know this. So getting rid of her, and also feeling that my materials were more available to me than they have ever been.
Your materials, your choice of words, your emotional depth?
It's the themes, really, that attract you and obsess you. In my case, why people do the things they do. What are the ranges of human possibility, both good and bad? Just human, human, human. Mm. So it's that kind of material. But also, my last two books, I have noticed I'm writing shorter, sharper, and crisper, and truth on a essential level is more important to me than ever before. I mean, if I'm going to write about loggerhead turtles, I want to know about them and not say anything that's false, fake.
Yeah. I do have to ask you, with this wonderful novel, I'm going to consciously phrase it this way. How many ghosts have you seen?
That's good for you. I didn't expect that. Okay, the sharp, true answer is I saw a bunch of them in my 36th year when I had moved to an old house by myself and made a lot of changes in my life, and they were all changes to do with forfeiting my security for a while. So I saw some people just in this house at night. And the other time was right after I got to Miami to work on the Miami Herald. I guess I was afraid. And I was living in this hotel near the old Miami Herald, it was called, the Robert Clay. And I woke up one night, and there was a man in white standing over my bed, and he looked like he was either going to choke me or feel my pulse. I never decided which. But I do believe my people, when they see ghosts, they really see them. And I've read a lot about this, and you're particularly vulnerable to it when your psyche is vulnerable and floats looser than usual from your body, from your stability. Have you never seen one?
I don't believe I've ever seen a ghost. I have heard my late mother.
Oh, your mother sounds wonderful. Listen, absence can always be present. Don't you believe that?
Yes, I do. Very much so. I believe in that. That helps us get through. Gail Godwin, her novel, Grief House. Thanks so much for being with us.
You are very welcome. It was nice talking to you.
And tomorrow on Weekend Edition Sunday, a conversation with John Grisham about his new book, Camino Island, A Gang of Thieves, Rare Books, and A Circle of Writers. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from C3IoT, providing a software platform that brings machine learning, big data, and cloud computing to industrial-scale predictive analytics and IoT solutions. Learn more at c3iot.com. And from the Gruber Family Foundation, supporting NPR's international coverage, covering the trends, moments, people, and movements that drive the world, always with the goal of creating a more informed public, one challenged and invigorated by events, ideas, and cultures.
This is 90.9 WBUR and WBUR.org. Wait, Don't Tell Me is next at 10 o'clock.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by GEICO, protecting people and their vehicles for over 75 years. GEICO is proud to offer car insurance and more to Massachusetts drivers, too. Additional information at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO. That's 1-800-947-AUTO. And Touch Tomorrow at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, a free family festival of science, technology, and robots, June 10th. More at tt.wpi.edu.
8-year-old Martin Richard was the youngest victim of the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. Now Martin's family is giving the city a park in his name.
Well, Martin loved this place. He loved the Children's Museum, and there wasn't a park that he didn't enjoy. You know, why not name a park for Martin?
I'm Bob Oakes. Ground will be broken for Martin Richard Park on June 10th. Join me for a tour of the site with Martin's dad, Bill, and Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, Monday on WBUR's Morning Edition.
From Boston University, this is 90.9 WBUR Boston, 92.7 WBUA Tisbury, and 89.1 WBUH Brewster. Online at WBUR.org and the new WBUR Listen app for iPhone and Android. WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.